Police video excerpt. Falcon Academy conference room interview. Bellman, Natalie Marie. Continued. Natalie's eyes dart back and forth between Detective Bradley, to her right, and Detective Larson, who is asking a question from behind the camera. Did you have a problem with Sloan Elliman Holt? Detective Larson asks, flipping through Natalie's private planner. A problem? No. But you wrote, I have to say she's not a particularly likable girl, full of herself, mean to others, and worst of all, flirtatious with boys, teachers, coaches, even school dads. Just like her mom, she embodies everything that's wrong with the school and the entitled kids that go here.
So you didn't like Sloan, Detective Bradley says. And it sounds like you didn't much like the mom either. Is that correct?
No, Natalie says, turning in her chair towards Detective Bradley. No, I mean, yes, it's true. I didn't much care for either of them. But you have to understand, Mrs. Elliman and her daughter had issues with everybody.
Could you give me an example?
He asks. Okay, Natalie said. They had issues with one another. Mother-daughter problems that were severe. They fought. All the time. Sloan was always getting in trouble with her boyfriend, Reed, and Mrs. Elliman was always furious with her. Did you ever have any altercations with Mrs. Elliman? Detective Larson asks. Natalie doesn't answer. Hmm? Detective Larson prompts. Again, no answer from Natalie. In your own words, Detective Larson begins to read, Friday the 16th, 20-mile bike ride plus 30 minutes of abdominals, ate well, grilled chicken and steamed spinach. The hungrier I get, the angrier I get. Mrs. Elliman talked down to me again. I'm afraid one of these days, one of these parents is going to say the wrong thing to me, and I'm going to just snap. 6. Late spring was Asha's favorite time of year. The air smelled of evergreen and a variety of mountain flowers, dominated by lilac. It was still cool enough that ceiling fans provided just the right breeze. She knew that several couples were driving in from out of town to see the Leopold estate, and she was on her way there to get the house ready. Speaking to her sister Karina on her headset as she drove up the mountain, she passed turnouts for trailheads, shuttle stops to local resorts, ski and bike racks, and carports sheltering snowmobiles and other all-terrain vehicles. Upset, Asha was driving slowly around the sharp switchbacks. Cars were starting to accumulate behind her, waiting for a passing lane. She was oblivious. I'm going to tell him, Karina, she said. My appointment with the doctor is this week. It makes sense to wait until after I get the official confirmation, right? Rather than jumping the gun? Asha kept weaving over onto the shoulder of the road. She took a deep breath and tried to focus. No, I don't think he's going to be over the moon. I've got to go. I'm here. The Leopold house was the most expensive in one of the older, less flashy suburbs on the outskirts of Falcon Valley, which, for a number of reasons, made it a tough sell. It had been on the market for 9 months, and the Leopolds had only recently acquiesced and approved the idea of an open house. Asha parked her car and attached some balloons to the wrought iron fence at the driveway entrance with twine and tape. Inside, everything looked perfect. The ivory jute fiber area rug had been the right choice after all. The texture and neutral color set off the luscious view of Mount Trinity, its green and fawn-colored fields highlighted in the picture window. Asha placed an opulent bouquet of white Asian lilies in the sea glass green vase on the entrance table before going into the kitchen and preheating the oven. After pulling a square package of Pillsbury ready-to-bake oatmeal raisin cookie dough from her purse, she broke the dough apart, spread it out on a cookie tray, and slipped it into the oven. While she waited, she walked slowly around the house, pretending that she was a buyer, looking for imperfections. After scrubbing away a strange, damp stain on the staircase wall leading down to the basement, she checked her phone. Almost noon. People would be arriving any minute. The oven timer went off, and she took out the cookies and transferred them to a cooling tray. She always went to great lengths to make sure her home smelled like cookies or citrus, comfort and tranquility. As she walked down the hall, she caught a whiff of something skunky. She covered her nose with the sleeve of her Kenzo floral print blazer and entered the library that had served as Mr. Leopold's office. It was a spectacular, utterly unique room, round and two stories, with an old-fashioned library ladder for the upper floor. On one side was a window looking out over the valley toward the mountains, and the bookcases were filled with antique hardcovers and exotic knick-knacks from around the world. Built into the curved wooden wall was a brick fireplace, a fluffy fur rug stretched out in front of it. Next to the fireplace, on the floor, touching the rug, was a pillow, one a person would use for sleeping. Plump and plain in a faded flowery cotton shell. It didn't belong in this marvelous, perfect room, and it had not been there 2 days earlier. Asha patted her hand against her chest in a useless gesture to quiet her heart, which had begun to beat faster. Kneeling, she ran her hand across the carpet. She flinched and jerked back with a cry. A bead of blood pulsed out from the tip of her finger, and Asha stopped it with the inside of her jacket sleeve. On closer inspection, there was a foot-wide area in which tiny shards of green glass were scattered and mostly invisible in the long fibers of the rug. With little time to spare, and no idea if the Leopolds owned a hand vacuum, she got on all fours, rolled up the rug, and pushed it behind the sofa. Then, her pulse racing, she turned back to face the room. It was obvious. Someone had been there. Something had happened. The flowers on the pillowcase were light coral in color. Asha was almost sure that the pattern matched the paint in one of the upstairs bedrooms. She brought the pillow to her face and sniffed. Marijuana? Those e-cigarettes, perhaps? The Leopolds did have grandchildren. College-aged, she thought. It was possible they'd been in the house. There was no reason to be worried or frightened. But she was. There seemed to be no safe places in her life anymore. Her marriage, which had never been perfect but always good enough, had become a source of constant anxiety. Her happy, good-smelling, well-staged home for sale seemed suddenly haunted, and she had the urge to leave. She tucked the pillow underneath her arm and walked out of the library, down the hall, up the stairs, and to the room she thought the pillow had been in the last time she'd visited. It really was a pleasing guest room, bright and sunny, containing a big bed, neatly made except for a missing pillow. Asha heard a noise from inside the walk-in closet. With a barely audible gasp, she whipped around to see the sliding door was partially open. She backed away as quietly as she could, but she was wearing heels. When she stepped off the area rug, they suddenly sounded loud against the hardwood floor. How stupid she'd been not to just run and call the police. Asha felt her knees go weak as the sliding closet door opened. Natalie poked her head out. Oh, hi, Asha. Asha thought maybe she was hyperventilating. She couldn't speak. Taking short, quick breaths, Asha finally managed. Thank God it's just you. Asha didn't bother crossing the room to the chair. She put her back against the wall and slid down into a cross-legged position. I'm so sorry I scared you. Who did you think it was? Asha shook her head. I don't know. A bad person who wants to hurt me, maybe? What? Who would want to hurt you? Natalie asked, slipping down the wall to have a seat next to her. I'm just a hormonal, pregnant, paranoid lady who doesn't know what's up from down right now. I'm sorry, Natalie. Natalie looked a little shocked. Are you pregnant? Asha let out a weak laugh. I guess that cat's out of the bag. You and I have only talked a handful of times, and yet you now know more about what's going on with me than my own family. That's not a very great state of affairs, is it? I can't believe I blurted that out. Please don't say anything. Who would I say something to? Of course not. But seriously, should I call someone? A doctor? Your husband? I'm fine. You're not fine. You're really shaking. Give me your hand. Do you mind? Asha placed her hand in Natalie's. Breathe, Natalie said, using her thumb to rub Asha's palm. You're okay. Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. They sat like that for a minute. Feel a little better? Natalie asked. Getting there. A second later, Asha asked, You didn't break a vase downstairs, did you? Or move anything from one room to another? Natalie looked confused and shook her head. No. With her other hand over her heart, as if to calm it, Asha asked, What about a bracelet? What about a bracelet? I lost one. Do you know anything about it? I'm not following Asha. Are you sure you're okay? Are you sure I shouldn't call your husband? Yes, I'm sure. What were you doing in there? Asha asked, gesturing towards the closet. I got here 10 minutes ago and the front door was open. I looked around for a little bit and then I ended up in here and saw the painting stacked in the back of the closet. I never looked through those, Asha said, appearing to relax even more. There are some really nice ones. The family should have an estate sale. Are you ready to get up? Yes. Natalie hauled herself to her feet and then leaned down to take both of Asha's hands in hers. Asha stood for a second, took two faltering steps, and had to sit on the bed. This is embarrassing. I'm okay, though, really. I'm just going through a lot right now. What can I do to help? Nothing, thank you. It's just the normal stuff. Some problems at home. Natalie leaned against the bed next to her. I'm familiar with that sort of situation. Anything you want to talk about? It felt far too personal to tell Natalie that she was afraid her husband had grown tired of her. It's nothing more than family nonsense. Mia, my daughter. Teenage drama. I know, Mia. Yes, of course you do. She's a great kid. Natalie paused. Isn't she? Oh, gosh, yes, she is. It's just, I don't know. I feel like I'm losing the connection that I've always had with her. In the last year, she's started hanging out in these chat groups with artists and musicians and wants to be a photographer or filmmaker in Los Angeles, and she thinks I'm a boring Midwestern real estate hack. Asha pulled a tissue from her pocket and blew her nose. She wants to move out of the state, far away. The only thing I know how to do is to help her with what she wants, because maybe then she'll see how much I love her and not dismiss me the way that she does. Honestly, Natalie said, having kids seems so hard. I don't know how anyone does it. She caught herself. Wait. Shit. I'm sorry. I forgot you're having another one. How dumb am I? And with a man who might be leaving me, Asha said without thinking. Suddenly, she leaned away from Natalie. I don't know what's wrong with me. I shouldn't be sharing such personal things. I apologize. It's not appropriate at all. And I ordinarily wouldn't behave like this, but... It's okay, Natalie said. It's fine. I wish... Before she could say anything further, the voice of an elderly woman came singing out from down the hall. Hello? Anybody here? Asha took a deep, steadying breath. Here we go. How do I look? Can you tell I've been crying? No, you have that trendy, smoky eye thing going. You look great. Really? Okay, thank you. Asha stood up and called. Be right there. She turned back to Natalie and said, I'm really sorry that I have to run like this. No worries, Natalie said. I have to go anyway. If you need to talk, you know where to find me. I'm pretty much always at my desk. Thanks, Natalie. Asha waved goodbye before straightening her jacket and walking to the door of the bedroom, singing, Here I am. Natalie breathed a sigh of relief. From her jeans pocket, she pulled the four pills she'd found in the sequined party purse, which had been stuffed along with some high-heeled shoes in a compartment of the hanging organizer in the closet. She'd become pretty good at identifying pills, and unfortunately, these were just aspirin. Not every house was a winner. After leaving the Leopold estate, Natalie headed to Jay's house on the other side of the valley, 10 miles away. Upon arriving at his wooden A-frame cabin with the adjacent carport sheltering all the bikes, motorcycles, snowboards, skis, sleds, and four-wheelers that he couldn't currently use, she let herself in the side door to the kitchen. She grabbed a Two Souls IPA from the fridge for Jay and carried it out to the patio coffee table that sat on a concrete slab at the edge of his overgrown yard. Hello there, she said, putting the beer down in front of her brother. His dragon head cane leaned against his chair. Much obliged, he said, grabbing the beer and raising it. He had hair the color of Natalie's before she dyed it a darker, burnt auburn. Jay's was a gentle ginger red. It was leonine and too long, a bright wavy halo around his head. On his jaw, he had growth that was more than stubble but not quite a beard, and his eyes were like hers, hazel and striking, with just a hint of here comes trouble. No problem, Natalie said, taking a seat across from him and then leaning to one side so she could pet Rocky.
I meant to ask, did you get some money a couple of weeks back?
Jay asked, extending his bad leg out to rest on one of the patio chairs.
You mean from Dad?
Yeah, she answered, pulling Rocky up onto her lap. It was easier than letting him claw her bare legs.
I only just got it, though. It had been returned to sender, and then he forwarded it to Mom, and then she forwarded it to me. It smelled like he fished it out of a pitcher of tips that had been marinating on a beer-soaked bar. Which is good, really, right? It means he's got a bartending job right now.
They sat quietly for a few minutes while Natalie ran her hand down the back of Rocky's neck. Jay suddenly laughed.
Do you remember the JJ?
The what?
The JJ. It was a drink he named after me. Remember how much I liked Dr. Pepper?
Yeah.
You were there, but maybe you were too young to remember. He called me to come into the kitchen and said, I invented a new drink. It was...
Jay started laughing again, but this time so hard he ended up coughing. He thumped his chest with his fist and went on.
It was Dr. Pepper, vanilla vodka, and a splash of grenadine. The worst part was, he wanted me to try it.
Shut up. No, he didn't.
And I was about to when Mom came in and smacked that drink right out of his hand.
Natalie pushed back her chair. Okay, she said. Come on, Rocky Dog. Let's put on your leash and go lose ourselves in the woods for a while.
You know what? Jay said, sliding Rocky's leash across the table to her. Sometimes I make myself a JJ.
Natalie hunkered down beside his chair to attach the dog's leash to his collar.
Is that a good idea?
I don't know. I try not to think about him too much.
Dr. Pepper with vanilla vodka is really good, but it makes me miss him when he was fun.
Here, Natalie said, handing Jay Rocky's leash. Take this for a sec. I'm just going to use the bathroom quick.
By the end of the 45-minute walk with Rocky, the Vicodin she'd taken from the bathroom medicine cabinet was kicking in. She stopped on the trail up the hill from Jay's street and called her mom.
Hey, Nat,
Betty answered.
Hi, Mom. Just wanted to check in and make sure everything's going well there.
It is. No problems. You and your brother okay?
Yeah, great.
There was a slight pause, and Betty said,
How are you feeling?
Really well.
Oh, good.
Betty sounded relieved.
I worry.
I know you do, but I'm a lot better now, I swear.
After a short chat, Natalie said,
I need to run, okay? Love you.
After hanging up, Natalie let Rocky sniff the underbrush to his heart's content while she took a couple of minutes. Then they continued on down the path that led to the woods behind Jay's backyard. Before opening the patio door, she used the sleeve of her coat to wipe away some dirt on the glass so she could lean in and inspect her reflection. It was fine. Jay wouldn't be able to tell that she'd been crying. 7. Aside from her kickboxing classes, there were few things that helped Brooke relax as much as grooming her horses. The morning had been wonderful, spent entirely at the stable and then having a euphoric ride through the fields on her favorite mare, Apple. She was in a good mood when she arrived home. That was about to change. After showering, Brooke traversed the mammoth home to search Sloane's bathroom. Her skin caviar luxe cream had gone missing, and though Sloane had her own jar, she was always running out and borrowing without asking. The cleaners weren't due for another 2 days, and Sloane's bathroom was a wreck. Tubes of body sparkle oozed like toothpaste next to the sink, and Sloane's hair was everywhere. In the sink drain, in the shower drain, on the floor, in a gnarled ball on her hairbrush. The Swiss skin caviar cream would have been easy to spot. The jar was bright blue. The only blue item in Sloane's top drawer was a small, medicinal-looking spray
that resembled the travel-sized antibiotic Brooke had long ago carried around in her purse to disinfect Sloane's scrapes on the playground. Brooke was curious. She picked it up and turned it this way and that. When she was at home, Brooke wore her reading glasses on a cord around her neck. She raised them to her eyes and squinted at the tiny print to read, Fat Richard's Deep Head Oral Anesthetic Spray. Brooke gasped and dropped it onto the counter. She wondered if she was losing her mind. Was it just candy-flavored medicine for sore throats? This was not true, and she knew it. Using her phone, she searched Fat Richard's Deep Head Oral Anesthetic Spray and found that the product had several reviews, most of which recommended it for deep throating without gagging. On top of everything else, Sloane was having sex. She was several months away from turning 16. Moreover, it appeared it wasn't just your average old groping, what are we doing, horny teenager humping, but a variety of creative, mature audiences only acts that were somehow harder for Brooke to accept. Brooke had first had intercourse with a boy named William, one of her Castle Peak camp archery counselors. He'd been 20 and she'd been 17, so this development with Sloane wasn't entirely unexpected. But this was different. Brooke tore Sloane's room to pieces in a methodical rage. It was lunchtime, Sloane was at school, and Brooke swore under her breath while she searched the mattress and box spring, ransacked drawers, and rifled through every bag in Sloane's closet. An hour later, she discovered just three more controversial items: a tube of mint chocolate chip flavored lube, a box of condoms, and a felt pouch containing the Let's Do It dice game, still in its plastic packaging, which read, An awesome fucking game. Brooke took photos of each item and texted them to Sloane, along with a message that said, Stay classy. She actually went as far as grabbing her car keys and purse with the intention of heading down to the school to drag Sloane out yet again, but she had second thoughts. In the past few months, she'd barged into the office to summon her daughter from class several times. Once when she'd found a joint in a makeshift Tupperware ashtray on the Juliet balcony off Sloane's bedroom, and then again when she'd found a stash of Dexedrine and Ritalin pills in a plastic Ziploc in her soccer team bag. Instead of getting in her car and driving down to the school, Brooke did something arguably more stupid. She texted Reed's mom, Linda Leland. I'm letting you know first. Sloane and Reed will no longer be seeing one another. I'm forbidding it. A second later, Linda texted back. Thank you. You beat me to it. I wish you luck with her. You have all my sympathy. Girls are just harder. A fog filled Brooke's head. A small drink might help, so she went to the garage and grabbed the limoncello from the big freezer. She had two shots and then checked the time. Sloane would be busy with school and private training for the next 4 hours. Gabe would be working from home at the new apartment, overseeing the team of millennials he employed to run his Psyche Active Outdoor Men's fashion line. It was a hobby job that Gabe took very seriously, and one that Brooke had financed initially to make him feel happy and productive. She continued to finance it in the hopes that their separation wasn't permanent. It took her 20 minutes to drive to the other side of the valley. She parked in the lot outside the Coy Creek Apartments and wondered if she should call him first. Fuck it, she said out loud. She used her card key to access the elevator, which opened directly into the entrance area of a single residence, like a fancy Manhattan loft. Brooke had been expecting to hear Gabe's music, maybe some Nirvana or Pearl Jam. He should have been seated, working at the desk in the living room by the sliding glass doors that looked out over the golf course. It seemed like no one was home. Gabe, she called, unwrapping herself from her multi-layered shawl. She tossed it under the arm of the couch. Gabe? Years earlier, just after they'd gotten married and before Sloane had been conceived, Gabe had caught her making out with another man. They'd been at a house party in Telluride, and he'd banged on the door of the bathroom door until Brooke had emerged alongside the drunken host. We were just doing a line, Brooke had said. Gabe had replied, Great, no problem.
Give me one, too.
There was no cocaine for Gabe, and it was obvious to everyone that there had been none in the first place. He'd forgiven her. After all, they were young, wild, and rich, and fearlessly played outside the rules. 4 years after Sloan was born, Brooke joined a morning playdate group that included a couple of dads. After grabbing a coffee in town, Gabe had stopped by Pilgrim's Park to surprise his wife and daughter, only to find that Sloan was being looked after by the other parents. After an investigation of the playground, pond, and picnic area, he found Brooke sitting in a car with a man, engaged in deep discussion. She rolled down the window and said, "Hi, honey, what are you doing here? This is my gay friend, Doug." Gabe had replied,
"If you're gay, why do you have an enormous boner for my wife right now?"
Those were just two of the times Brooke had disappointed him. 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, 12. Incident, 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 incident. No proof of anything more than casual dalliances. No admissions. No breakdowns, no physical fights, accusations, or begging. Just less trust, comfort, and love. Gabe had tolerated her need for attention until a cold night the previous December outside the soccer barn. Christmas lights had been strung through the trees, making the parking lot of the indoor soccer arena strangely festive and romantic. She'd been wearing her favorite hand-knitted stocking cap, and her icy skin was pink and glowing. Coach Nick had made a controversial decision to replace the team's midfielder with Sloan because the opposition team's best defender was incredibly fast. Sloan had risen to the occasion and run up and down the field, showcasing her defensive skills while never slowing down on offense. She shut down the other team handily, while at the same time scoring 3 goals to win the game. Dozens of spectators gathered to give her high fives as she left the field. While Gabe waited inside by the locker room for Sloan to get changed, Brooke had walked outside to enjoy the feeling of cool air and victory. Coach Nick exited on his own, and she called him over to where she was standing under a tree on the snowy edge of the parking lot. He gave her a quick hug. Brooke placed one hand on his neck and pulled him in for a kiss. Her tongue went searching and found his. Her groin pushed forward and he was aroused. "Oh," she said against his skin. "That's nice."
"Brooke,"
he said, his voice hoarse.
"Yes?"
Coach Nick was looking over her shoulder. He ran his hand over his face.
"Jesus."
Gabe was standing behind them. 2 days later, Gabe left for a hotel. And 5 days after that, Brooke bought an apartment on the opposite side of the river where he could live while they saw a therapist and worked things out. Gabe had said,
"Don't buy it. I may not stay."
Brooke had more money than she could possibly spend in several lifetimes and didn't mind the cost. She said,
"It's an investment. I can rent it. And it's someplace Sloan can come and spend time with you while we sort this out."
It had never occurred to Brooke until recently that Gabe might not forgive her and eventually come home. The apartment was a beautiful 3-bedroom penthouse with a spacious, modern kitchen and a huge open space living area with a home theater. The balcony looked out over the golf course, tennis courts, picnic tables, and fire pits. At the far end of the property was a trailhead sign. After a few twists and turns on the map, you could hike or bike anywhere you wanted in the valley after walking out the door. There was a bowl of moldy limes on the kitchen counter. The refrigerator was empty. And in the freezer, there was only a bottle of Stolichnaya that was almost empty. He was gone. She dialed his cell phone. No answer. Looking around, she saw the landline, a metal and black plastic contraption. Strange, really, given that they were antiquated and mostly useless. She picked it up and called him again. He answered with a weary resignation.
"You're in the apartment, I see."
"Hi, Gabe."
"What's going on?"
"I wanted to talk to you about Sloan," she said. It was the one thing that he couldn't refuse.
"Is something wrong?"
"Yes, a lot is wrong."
"How can I help?"
"You can help by parenting. You can help by forgiving me and coming home," Brooke wanted to say. "You can help by being part of our family again." She was about to tell him what she'd found in Sloane's bathroom, and then had second thoughts. What if he blamed her and her parenting? Brooke took a deep breath and looked out the window. In the distance, two tiny golf carts were zipping along a concrete path.
You know she wants to go to UCLA, of course.
I know you want her to go to UCLA.
She wants to. Just ask her.
Fine. What's the problem?
Well, now her friend Mia wants to go there too.
I don't understand. That's great. It's good to have friends with you wherever you go.
No. You're missing the point. Coach Nick has a thing with one of the recruiters for UCLA. They played together or hung out together, I don't know. But if this contact is going to take one of Coach Nick's girls, it's only going to be one, do you understand? One.
Mia isn't as good a player as Sloane. She's talented, obviously, but she's not nearly as aggressive, and I don't think her ball-handling skills are on par with Sloane's.
The rules are all over the place now, Gabe. It's not just who's the best player. They care about diversity and adversity. That's what they call it. You can look it up. It's part of how the universities choose who they're going to allow in. It's part of the admissions process.
Adversity and diversity?
Yes, exactly. Mia is brown, Gabe. She's brown. Her mom is Indian. If Coach Nick recommends them both and Mia is almost as good as Sloane, they'll take Mia because she's brown.
Brooke, you sound like a racist nutjob, which I know you're not. But seriously, stop. There are plenty of spots at plenty of colleges.
How are you going to feel if Mia gets accepted to UCLA and Sloane has to go live and play in some armpit part of the country? Gabe sighed loudly, and Brooke was perturbed. Seriously, Gabe, how will you feel?
More importantly, Brooke, how will you feel?
What are you now, my therapist? I will feel shitty, Gabe. I will lose sleep. I will feel like I'm a bad mom, and I should have done more and tried harder and been better.
This sounds a bit like the speech you gave me when I was moving out.
It's all true. I should have tried harder. I should have been better, for you and Sloane. Help me here, Gabe.
I'll do whatever I can for Sloane. As for us, come on, Brooke. What's done is done.
Brooke sank down onto the plush couch. Please don't say that. I love you. I'm going crazy without you. Please don't say what's done is done. We have a history. We took a ferry to Ibiza together. We wrecked a motorcycle together. Brooke started to cry. We lost a baby together, and we made another one, and we raised her together. We belong together. You're the only one who makes me laugh. Please, Gabe, I'm sorry. I won't do it again. I won't, I promise.
Brooke, I'm not even angry anymore. I loved you, and I will always be there for Sloane. But you aren't losing your mind because you lost me. You're losing your mind because you've never lost, period. You've always gotten everything you wanted, and you need to win. I wish I could give you the win you need, but I can't. I'm sorry.
Your stuff is gone, Gabe, without even telling me.
Can you blame me? I didn't want to live there. In an apartment you bought me to try to keep me close, to keep tabs on me. God, I felt like a kept man.
Where are you?
I decided I was more comfortable staying with Tabitha for the time being.
You're living with the underage spin instructor?
23. She's 23 and she was a double major in kinesiology and nutrition at-
Please, Gabe, stop. I don't want to know what she studied in high school. Could you put her on the phone, please?
Stop with the crazy demands. Why do you think you can yell at someone to do something and they'll automatically do it?
Put her on the phone!
I can't put her on the phone. I'm not with her. She's at work. She works, like a normal person.
Brooke understood then that her uniqueness, her money, her beauty and privilege, had suddenly gone rotten. She was no longer as desirable as normalcy. Boring was better. Young and dumb was better. Poor and needy, low maintenance and thankful. That was what was attractive. The world had turned upside down. She hung up. With the back of her right hand, she smacked the Italian salad bowl on the counter. It flew down the length of the bar and off the edge, shattering when it hit the floor. Brooke clutched her hand and opened her mouth in silent agony. She'd hit a vein, and a purple bruise was spreading rapidly, already the size of a quarter. This had happened to her mom when she was diagnosed with a blood disorder at the age of 70. Brooke was getting old. After a few minutes, the pain subsided. Brooke picked up the multicolored shards from the bowl, put them in an old Walgreens plastic bag, along with the moldy limes, and dumped it all in the trash. She poured herself a shot from the vodka bottle that was in the freezer. After she finished it, she called Coach Nick. He didn't pick up, so she dialed him again. And again. With each unanswered call, she grew more resentful. She poured herself the last of the delicious, freezing vodka. Her tongue and throat went cold. Eventually, she left a voicemail message. She said, "Just so you know, I don't like to be ignored." Police video excerpt, Falcon Academy conference room interview, Bellman, Natalie Marie, continued. Detective Larson walks into the frame and deposits a mug of tea in front of Natalie. She then disappears. Natalie tries to take a sip and finds the tea too hot. She touches her lip and makes a face before pushing the mug away. Detective Bradley is reading his notes silently. After a minute, he looks up.
"You said a little while ago that Sloane's biggest problem was her mom. Was it just your typical, I'm mad that you don't approve of my boyfriend type of problem, or more than that?"
"I don't think Sloane liked the fact that her mom was also, I don't know, on the prowl." Detective Bradley raises an eyebrow.
"On the prowl?"
"Yes," Natalie confirms. "I heard through the school grapevine that Sloane was upset that her mom had cheated on her dad, and that he left the family afterwards." Detective Larson pipes up from behind the camera. "Who did Brooke cheat with? Do you know?" After a long pause, Natalie shakes her head. "Are you sure?" Detective Larson goes on. "Are you sure it wasn't with Asha Wilson's husband, Phil?" Natalie leans back in her chair, looks up at the ceiling, and lets out a long breath. "Did I write that in the planner? I don't remember writing that."
"You did,"
Detective Larson says, and then there's a long stretch of silence.
"Did Asha Wilson know what was going on?"
"She did," Natalie answers.
"And how did she find out?"
Natalie reaches over to pull the tea towards her and tries again to take a sip. It's still hot.
"Ow,"
she says. Detective Larson ignores this and repeats the question.
"Natalie, how did Asha Wilson find out about her husband's infidelity with Brooke Elliman?"
"She found out when I told her." 8. The apartment complex where Natalie lived was inexpensive and mostly empty during the off-season. Though Falcon Valley was 20 minutes from the closest ski resort, it still had its fair share of identical chalet-style apartment complexes lining the hills, ideal for people who weren't able to afford ski-in and ski-out accommodations. Natalie had gotten a very good deal on her little place. While she'd enjoyed the winter hustle and bustle of families coming and going, making a racket with all their skis and boards, boots and poles, the spring had been relaxing and quiet. She had plans with Yvonne later that evening to grab sushi, and she figured she had plenty of time to get in a workout first. It was a sunny, crisp, and breezy Saturday, perfect running weather. Natalie left her apartment and drove to the school, parking her car out in the back of the sports pavilion before walking up the hill behind the football field to the start of the cross-country course. She was surprised to see someone standing near the stone bench that marked the entrance of the running trail that went into the woods. As Natalie approached, she saw that it was a tall woman in a skirt, jacket, and heels. Not exactly the right outfit for the cross-country course. It wasn't until Natalie got even closer that she realized the woman was crying. For a second, Natalie considered asking if she could help, but then the woman sank to her knees and began scratching at the ground below the bench in a frenzied way. Natalie wasn't comfortable witnessing this display of either instability or profound grief. She gave the bench a wide berth and darted into the woods, sprinting far and fast away from all that sadness. When she finished her run, the woman was gone. Natalie walked over to the bench. She'd sat there many times, recovering, but she'd never noticed the engraved plaque underneath. It had always been hidden by grass, leaves, snow, or dirt. Now it was uncovered. The woman had cleared away the winter's accumulation of brush to reveal a shiny square of marble bearing the following inscription. In loving memory of Jill Ruiz, your wings were ready, but my heart was not. Walking down the hill and across the football field, Natalie felt heavy-hearted, picturing the sobbing woman clawing at the ground. It must have been the girl's mother. Imagine, she thought, to lose your child that young. It brought to mind a saying her own mom had repeated to her often when she was younger. Be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about. Natalie was still thinking of Jill Ruiz's mother 5 minutes later when she rounded the corner leading to the mezzanine, completely in her own world, and collided with Coach Carmen, who was barreling down the stairs. Oof, Natalie exclaimed, falling backwards onto her butt. Coach Carmen was sturdier. Sorry, she said, sounding unashamedly insincere. She didn't stop to offer a hand. If anything, she continued hurtling down the corridor, looking even less in control. For a split second, Natalie was ready to say, "You should watch where you're going," but the words were right there. Be kind. Instead, she called, "Hey, are you okay?" No answer from the disappearing woman. Natalie shook it off, climbed the stairs, and walked onto the mezzanine. Coach Nick was there. He was alone. Natalie suddenly remembered that it was a 3-day weekend. Lots of families would have left town. The music was much louder than when the students were around being trained. She recognized the band. He was listening to Mumford and Sons and singing passionately about living his life as it was meant to be. He was facing the mirror with his back to her. She watched him quietly. For a second, she thought he was talking to himself, but then she glanced down at the ground. A big, shaggy, gold-colored dog was lying off to the side, chewing on some sort of toy. All of a sudden, he exclaimed, "Yes, you know it. You know it. You are a good boy," and leaned over to give the dog a scratch around his floppy ears. Turning his attention back to his weights, he took a second to get his grip right on the barbell below. With a strained exhalation that she could barely hear over the music, he raised it to waist level. Letting out another similar grunt, he brought the barbell up to shoulder level. He held it there, his whole body trembling. Sinewy lines of definition cut through his arms, and yet he wasn't bulky, just healthy and perfectly made. Finally, he raised the bar over his head, and the sleeves of his t-shirt slipped down around his arms, revealing the rounded swells of his shoulders. Natalie was staring. As her mind wandered, so did her eyes, slipping down to the several inches of strapping back visible beneath the bottom of his shirt. In the mirror, she could also see his stomach, two grooves on either side of his abdominals, forming a V-shape, narrowing as they disappeared under the waistband of his shorts. The dog barked and stood, looking in her direction. Coach Nick lowered the barbell and dropped it to the floor. She felt the vibration under her feet. Sweat was running down his cheeks and neck, and his tousled hair was damp. His blue eyes were locked on hers in the mirror. "Hey, you," he said in a familiar way that suggested they knew each other better than they did. "Hey," she said back, forcing herself to walk forward rather than back away. Her heart was racing, and her cheeks felt like they were on fire. Coach Nick put one hand on his dog's head and said,
"This is Jackson. He's friendly, but maybe too friendly, if you know what I mean."
Upon being introduced, Jackson promptly crossed the mezzanine and greeted Natalie with a curious and vigorous investigation of all her personal scents. "Yes, you're not kidding," she said with a laugh. She did an awkward dance trying to extricate herself from Jackson's probing nose.
"Good thing you're a dog person," Coach Nick said.
Jackson seemed satisfied with his investigation and sat, panting with his tongue out, wide eyes begging Natalie to reciprocate the attention.
How'd you know?
Natalie asked, patting Jackson's head.
You have a little painting of your dog on your desk, don't you?
Oh, she said. You notice that? Wow, yes, I do. That would be Rocky, my brother's dog.
You have a painting of your brother's dog on your desk?
Well, yeah, I painted it.
Oh,
he exclaimed.
That's cool. I remember thinking it was really good.
Thank you.
Natalie realized that she wanted Coach Nick to think she was clever and funny. She wanted it suddenly and very badly. They stood there, smiling and quiet. He wiped away some sweat from his forehead, and she coughed.
So, Coach Carmen just nearly knocked me down a second ago on the stairs. I thought maybe a bomb went off up here.
Oh, did she?
He asked, shaking his head.
Sorry.
Everything okay?
Sure.
Nick nodded for a beat too long, and then seemed to change his mind.
No, actually, I'm lying. It wasn't okay. We had a disagreement about how to discipline a student who made a really terrible mistake. Carmen was upset. I don't blame her. It's hard when kids you like mess up and you have to, you know.
I get it.
So, artist,
he said,
is it okay to ask why you're doing office work instead of being a painter?
It's called money.
He smiled.
Money. It's always money, isn't it?
It is, she answered. I was going to be an art teacher once upon a time, but I had to drop out of school a little early. Family stuff.
It's nice to finally talk to you. Why haven't we done this before?
We've exchanged a few words.
That's true, and I think I did try to flirt with you once.
And I think I might have flirted back.
When I was dilly-dallying in front of your desk?
Nick reached out and tucked a loose lock of her hair behind her ear, sending an unexpected warm tingle up Natalie's neck.
Or was it when I came over and gave Mia Wilson my water bottle on the basketball court, and I caught you looking down my tie-dye tank top?
He shook his head.
I did not. I don't even remember the tank top in question. It wasn't blue, orange, and white with little knots at the shoulders, and you weren't wearing a neon green sports bra underneath it.
That's too bad. I was hoping you'd remember me.
I apologize for the fact that you made no impression on me whatsoever.
Forgiven, she answered.
Can I interest you in a game of horse? Let's play something.
Horse? She asked. Basketball is not my thing.
Nick leaned away and assessed her.
You could have been a point guard. What are you, about 5'4"?
Precisely, she said. And a lousy shot.
So you don't want to play horse, okay?
Nick rubbed his chin while he pretended to think.
There's other things we could do. I could buy you a drink.
I'm sorry, I don't drink.
What?
Nick didn't look disappointed, just surprised.
Don't take this the wrong way, but you look like a drinker. You've got that party girl look about you.
Natalie snorted.
I hope I don't have that look about me when I'm sitting in the Falcon front office.
No, you don't. And why don't you drink?
He asked.
If you don't mind me asking.
I was a bit of loose cannon back in the day. I've got some other vices, but alcohol wasn't working for me.
All right, fair enough. No drink for us then.
A Powerade Mountain Berry Blast would be pretty great right about now, though. And maybe some tater tots or cheddar bites, if you still wanted to take me out.
Let me get this straight. Are you inviting me to the Sonic Drive-In down the road?
That's exactly what I'm doing.
Nick grinned.
You're my new favorite person. That's Jackson's number one restaurant.
Nick turned and snapped his fingers, and the golden retriever trotted over.
Isn't that right, Jackson? Do you want to go to Sonic?
Jackson barked and began to wag his tail.
His favorite is the popcorn chicken.
What a lucky boy,
Natalie said, already wondering where this could possibly be going. She hadn't been so nervous, excited, and hopeful about someone in a long time. The fact that she had a date with Yvonne in a couple of hours was the farthest thing from her mind. Yvonne had glued fake eyelashes to her lids and was wearing green-colored contacts. She was dressed up in black bell-bottoms, platform boots, and a see-through shirt over a silver bra, all because Natalie had said, "I'll tell my brother to meet us. I don't know if he'll come, but I can ask. Is that okay with you?" Yvonne was humming along with the music in the lounge of Sakura while she picked at edamame, drank sake, and scrolled through her Snapchat. She had no idea that Jay was ashamed of his cane and his limp, and that he'd chosen not to join. Also, she had no idea that for the first time in years, Natalie was in the presence of someone she enjoyed so much that she completely, 100%, forgot about her other plans, until it was too late to appropriately cancel. At 7:45, when she was already 15 minutes overdue to arrive, Natalie texted Yvonne, "So sorry, stomach bug. Please forgive me. Rain check for next weekend. I will treat to apologize. You okay?" Yvonne closed her tab and got a takeout box of seared ahi and a kamikaze roll. "I'm barfing," Natalie shot back. Yvonne had no idea Natalie was lying naked in bed while Nick was using the bathroom. "Just so you know, when it's your treat, I'm getting the lobster caviar roll and my own bottle of Veuve." "As you should, girl. Huge hug and thanks for understanding." "No biggie. Feel better." The rest of the bottle of sake went down smoothly. As Yvonne was walking out, she spotted Brooke Elliman, a Falcon mom she didn't like, sitting at a bar table not far from the entrance, sipping something green in a martini glass. "Hi there, Mrs. Elliman," Yvonne said, because there was no way to walk past without an acknowledgement. "Oh, hi, Miss
Chun."
"Chun." Brooke seemed distracted.
"Everything okay?"
Yvonne asked, feeling a little loose and neighborly after having an entire sake bottle all to herself.
"Fine, everything is fine. My friend's late, that's all. And not answering my texts. Annoying."
"If it makes you feel any better, I got dressed up and stood up,"
Yvonne said, gesturing down at her fancy pants and platform shoes.
"I didn't get stood up," Brooke responded flatly.
And it was true. Coach Nick had never promised to meet her. She'd told him that she would be at Sakura that night, with friends, and that he should swing by. When he said, "That sounds like fun," she'd taken it as a yes. She'd been wrong. It seemed like not a single day went by that Brooke didn't feel more belittled and unappreciated. Yvonne immediately raised both hands and said,
"Oh, no, of course you didn't get, stood up. My bad. See you at school."
Brooke went back to her phone.
"Are you coming or not?"
9. Sloan Elliman Holt, wearing Gucci silk twill track pants and a hoodie, trotted up the stairs leading from the driveway to Greg Woodson's front door. She'd been dating Greg's close friend, Reed, for several months, and had been spending a lot of time at the Woodson house. The porch was an enormous stained concrete slab, bordered by urns potted with a variety of ferns and flowers. At opposite edges were slanting pillars of red rock, inspired by the surreal beauty of the local canyons. She rang the doorbell, and Mr. Woodson opened the door. He waved her in distractedly as he continued to converse on his headset about something that involved the words methane, biodiesel, and landfill. Sloane slipped off her shoes and left them by the door. As she walked past the kitchen, she glanced in and saw Greg's mom sitting at the breakfast bar with her laptop open and a glass of wine. Her name was Susie, and on previous visits, Sloane had found her to be unexpectedly nice, considering she was reputedly a cutthroat businesswoman.
"Hiya,"
Sloane said, zipping by with a little wave in an attempt to get past without stopping to talk. Susie looked up and appeared to be delighted.
"Hi there, Sloane. Nice to see you. Did your mom just drop you off?"
"Uh-huh," Sloane lied. She'd begged a ride off an older girl from her soccer team.
"Darn, if I'd known, I would have gone out to say hi. Is Mia coming over tonight, too?"
"Probably not," Sloane answered, reluctantly doubling back to stand in the doorframe.
"Oh, too bad. How are you?"
"Good, and you?"
"Great, thanks. I do love it when you come over," Susie said. "I'm always the only girl in the house."
Susie had to be pushing 50, Sloane thought, but if she wanted to call herself a girl, fine.
How are your mom and dad?
Sloane hesitated.
Okay.
What are they up to these days? I haven't seen your mom in ages.
She stays busy with her board meetings, charities, and horses.
And your dad?
You know, it's weird, Sloane said, very little inflection in her voice. She might as well have still been talking about her mom's charities and horses. He left.
What?
Susie lowered her wine glass to the marble countertop with a crack, and then had to steady it to keep it from toppling.
Yeah, they had a fight, and he left and hasn't been back for, like, months.
Sloane, I had no idea. I'm so sorry.
Shit, Sloane thought. Susie was starting to inch her little bony butt off the bar stool. She actually was going to get up, come over, and go in for that hug.
It's fine, Sloane said urgently, backing up. I'm going downstairs now, please. Is that okay?
The deer-in-the-headlights look in Sloane's eyes was not lost on Susie.
Of course it's okay.
Susie sat back down and reached for her wine glass.
I really do hope everything works out for the best.
Thanks, Mrs. Woodson. In the basement, Reed was doing lines off the coffee table, and Greg was holding a gray metal canister and a full balloon. He'd gotten a hold of his favorite nitrous oxide. Reed saw Sloane emerge at the bottom of the stairs and stood up, arms out. She never got tired of being wrapped up against his powerful chest.
What took you so long?
My mom made many petty appointments for us earlier. Then I had to wait until she was on the couch watching her show so I could leave without her looking out the window. Sorry, Reed said.
That's so cute,
followed by his best boy band smile. He regularly posted photos of himself on Rich Kids of Instagram, and he fit the bill. Thanks to his parents' wealth, he'd benefited from expensive acne medications, human growth hormone injections, the best orthodontists, 3 years of personal training sessions with Coach Nick, bleached teeth, electrolysis on spots of unwanted hair, highlights and lowlights, nutritious food, and a personal masseuse to relieve stress. In his photos, he often posed sitting on the hood of his white Mercedes-Benz G-Class SUV wagon, sticking his tongue out while throwing gang signs with both hands. Sloane and Reed had been dating on and off for a few months, even though they had little in common except for wealth and sports. And cocaine.
Can I get a bump? Sloane asked.
With a gentlemanly,
allow me.
Reed took a vial from his jacket pocket and tapped some out on the glass tabletop. He used his Falcon student ID card to cut it up and then formed two thin lines. Reed's phone rattled on the coffee table. Greg said,
oh, see if that's Jeremiah. He's with Alistair and Casper. They're supposed to be coming over to do a death dab challenge for Casper's YouTube channel.
Reed looked at his phone.
It's Coach Nick. What time is it? Greg, turn the music down, will you?
What does he want? Greg asked.
How should I know?
Reed answered and said brightly, as if he'd not been drinking and doing cocaine for hours.
Hi, Coach. Yes, I got your message. Tomorrow, 2 to 4 instead of 1 to 3. It's not a problem at all.
Greg and Sloane were watching Reed.
Just hanging out with Greg and Sloane? What about you? Oh, really? Nice. Lasagna's the best. Okay, cool.
Reed's expression changed from toleration to exasperation, and he said,
Sloane, Coach Nick would like to FaceTime with you for a second.
Sloane mouthed, no, but Reed had already hit the FaceTime button and turned the phone towards her. She pulled it together.
Hey, Coach Nick, she said, waving.
The image was Nick in his own kitchen, walking around while cooking. He had his phone in one hand. With his other, he tasted a red sauce from a wooden spoon.
Hi, Sloane, how's it going? Everything good?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, he said. I'm happy to hear that. Your mom told me that you and Reed were taking some time apart. Did I get that wrong?
Shit, Reed said softly.
Oh, it's fine, Sloane said. I just swung by Greg's house to pick up my jacket. I left it here the other night, so anyway, that's all I'm doing. I'll be leaving in a sec. I'm not banned from seeing Reed or anything. Whatever you heard from my mom. Reed gestured for her to stop talking by drawing his hand across his neck.
So, I'm leaving in a minute. Less than a minute.
Sloane sniffed.
Well, okay. You know if you need anything, just don't hesitate to reach out. We're all here for you. Your mom and I are working together. Great things to come.
I know that. I totally know that. Thank you, again.
Use good judgment, Sloane.
I will, Coach Nick.
Reed turned the FaceTime back on himself.
Well, it was nice of you to, he paused, check in with us. Tonight, we appreciate it. You kids behave yourselves, all right? Don't worry, sir, we will.
Reed hung up and said to Sloane,
what is wrong with that guy?
He's just looking out for me. My mom asked him to, that's all.
Greg came over and sat down, his pupils huge.
What an intrusive dick. I could ask my dad to get him fired. Fuck getting someone to fire him, Reed said, tossing the phone onto the couch. It would be easier just to get rid of him ourselves, and more fun, too.
10. On one side of the football field, the crew from Premier Party Rental was busy setting up the enormous inflatable movie screen in front of the goalposts. Asha was on the opposite end by the parking lot, having a look through several plastic tubs filled with granola bars, fruit roll-ups, and baggies of popcorn. It was outdoor movie night at Falcon Academy, and even though the sun wouldn't set behind the mountains for another hour, families were already spreading out their blankets, unpacking picnic baskets, and discreetly sipping cocktails out of plastic tumblers. The younger students ran amok around the field while the older ones had spread out across the upper portion of the bleachers in small clusters.
I'm here,
Brooke called breathlessly, running across the field gingerly in boots with heels. Asha, who had just begun to transfer organic Gatorades into a cooler filled with ice, looked up and smiled.
Hi, Judy and Dave are late too, don't worry.
Sorry, Brooke said, reaching Asha's side and taking in the festival atmosphere of the fundraiser appreciatively. To be honest, I totally forgot that I let myself get roped into this the last time I was up at the school. Sloane reminded me.
Well, I'm glad you remembered. Can you help me with the folding table?
Here, Brooke said, picking it up off the ground and starting to release the legs. Let me just do it myself. You know, your condition and all, little mama. I take it Phil and the kids are in on the secret by now? Asha glanced at Brooke and hesitated.
What? No? Asha, you've got to tell them. How far along are you?
It's early days. I think it's too soon to be making a big deal about it, especially when Phil is acting a little off. I'm just being cautious.
Brooke did not look at all convinced.
Okay, well, Phil has a lot going on. Give him some time then, you know, to sort things out.
Sort what out?
Asha asked, stopping what she was doing.
You know.
No, I don't know. She put her hands on her hips and blew a piece of hair off her face.
Sort what out? What exactly are you talking about?
Brooke appeared to be suddenly flustered and at a loss for words. Very unlike her.
I just meant, you know, life, kids, work. We all have a lot on our plates, and I assume he's no different. I shouldn't have said anything. I don't know anything.
She paused. I obviously pushed a button. I'm sorry. Asha's hands were still on her hips, defiantly, as she mulled over this answer. After a second, it was as if the wind left her sails. She sighed.
No, that was my fault. I'm not myself these days.
She grabbed a Gatorade and wrestled with the cap.
Mia and all this college stuff. Ugh.
The college stuff, Brooke said, bristling. Well, maybe if Mia hadn't decided suddenly that she wanted to go to UCLA, the school her best friend had been dreaming about for her whole life, it wouldn't be so complicated.
Well,
Asha threw up her hands and laughed as if she'd messed up again.
I guess I pushed a button too.
Brooke rubbed her forehead as if she had a headache. Yes, it's true. I never used to be this on edge. Doesn't it seem like everyone's on edge lately?
Mia certainly is. What's happening between our girls anyway?
Asha shook her head sadly.
Why aren't they friends anymore the way they used to be?
Is it just this stupid issue that they both want to go to the same college? I mean, does anyone stop to think they might both get in? That would be wonderful.
I think that's unlikely, Asha.
Impossible. And anyway, they're still friends. It's just more competitive than it was when they were little. At least they had that sleepover at your house last weekend.
The girls haven't had a sleepover at our house in months, Asha said, looking alarmed.
I hope Sloane didn't...
No, you're right, Brooke said. I'm confused. Time flies when you're busy, and I have been very, very busy. My dad's retiring as chairman, and I've had to go to tons of board meetings in Denver that drag on all evening. Gabe was in charge of Sloane, and I just didn't check in because I was so busy, and you know what? Speaking of which, oh my God, I have to run.
Oh, what? You're leaving now already?
The slightly frantic look on Brooke's face stopped Asha from saying more.
I completely forgot about a conflicting commitment. Asha, I'm so sorry.
Of course, that's fine. Thank you for helping me with...
Asha looked around at all the snacks and drinks left to be arranged and sold throughout the evening.
With opening the table.
You're welcome, Brooke said,
backing away and scrounging in her oversized purse for her phone. She turned and race walked towards her car, fingers flying over the screen.
You have been lying to me. You were not at Mia's house when you said you were.
No response.
You know that you are not allowed to see Reed Leland, much less spend the night with him.
No response.
Where are you right now?
No response.
Tell me where you are. I don't want you seeing that boy. I mean it. Where are you? I am considering calling the police.
What? Don't freak out and don't call the police, Mom, for fuck's sake. Please, you don't want them involved in this.
In what? Involved in what?
Someone from the school is probably going to be calling you. I got into some trouble. Do me a favor and try not to lose your shit like always.
It wasn't until Asha had handed out organic Gatorades to several dozen Falcon athletes that the words hit her like a punch to the stomach.
My dad's retiring as chairman, and I've had to go to tons of board meetings in Denver.
Asha took the key card she had found in Phil's trash can out of the zippered compartment in her purse where she was keeping it and double-checked the hotel.
Le Meridien.
She texted Brooke.
I've got some overnight business in Denver myself. What hotel do you like?
Brooke never responded.